Okay.
So, let's see here.
They used to, what, 14?
Maybe 14.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, my goodness, it's 15.
And, you know what this is? Is William James, actually.
Who's that? Never heard of him. I thought he was just a figment of our imagination, Don.
But before I get there, I wanted to address Tom's question some more. So, you see, Tom, you shouldn't have asked me that question.
The one from last week?
Yeah, because I'm not satisfied with my answer. I give my answer a C, maybe, something like that.
Not even a gentleman, C.
What?
No. So Tom's question was really a good question. We were talking about PERS, of course. We were talking about how to make our ideas clear. And PERS, remember the general context that PERS paints is, okay, there's doubt, which is always a stimulus to belief because it's an uncomfortable situation. And then there's belief, which is, the resolution, and you're now on placid waters, right? And then that's kind of step one. In fact, I put it on the board, right? So there's doubt.
Yes.
Oh, and then thought.
Right.
Because you got to get to the state of belief, and that requires thought. And then there's John, Patty. And then belief, which is, now we're on planet waters, right? And then that becomes ingrained in some sort of habit, which in turn stimulates volition, and then action. And of course, that's the whole beating heart of pragmatism, right? We tend to think, I guess you could put it this way, we often tend to think, okay, this is purely theoretical over here, and over here is purely practical, and there's never the twain shall meet, right? And what Peirce is saying is, hey, this wall that you imagine that exists here, it's not there, right? And that, as a matter of fact, this stuff over here has effects over here. And as a matter of fact, not only that, but the most important thing about this stuff over here are the effects that it has over here. So that's why, then, he says, after that, build-up, that the meaning of a... If you want to make your ideas clear, you have to say what sort of actions would result from those ideas. If, for example, you have two ideas and they have the same practical effects, then there is no difference between them. Hi!
Hello.
Well.
Hi!
So, see how long you... before somebody comes in here and says, we need you urgently, or something like that. We'll lock the door. So, but anyway, so then Tom asked me last week, he asked me the question, he said, well, how about the Copernican theory, because that's not a practical kind of thing, that's pure scientific theory and all that sort of thing. And my answer was, my answer is partially correct, I think, but it could have been better. And I drew this diagram over here, and my answer is, the action that you're thinking of is a subset of really all possible practical effects. And I mentioned, for example, the fact that back in the day, there's Reuben. Patty, that's Reuben. Back in the day, back in around 1600, the practical effect that would be relevant would be something like the phases of Venus. Remember, I talked about the phases of Venus. Because on the Ptolemaic view, there's Warnetta, Patty. On the Ptolemaic view, because Mercury and Venus are always right near the sun, either just after sunset or just before sunrise, they would have to be very closely aligned, and they're orbiting around the Earth is the idea. But on the Copernican view, with the sun in the middle, then it's possible to have the Earth and Venus at right angles, you know, with the Sun, or even a full Venus if Venus is mostly behind the Sun. So you should see phases of Venus, in other words, if the Copernican theory is true. That's a practical effect. That's what the Galileo, of course, saw. But anyway, and I was construing your action as being something a little narrower. But I think Peirce is thinking of it in a broader sense. And so I think if you ask Peirce that question as opposed to me, Peirce might have said, well, nah, Don, he's a little bit messed up here. He doesn't quite understand what I'm saying. I'm really saying that this action thing is really very, very broad, including things like scientific experiments. And so certainly looking through a telescope and seeing if we see phases of Venus is a scientific experiment. It's an action that people take in order to determine if this theory makes any sense or not. You see what I mean?
Well, so part of it was whether it was Peirce was getting a personal action.
Exactly.
Or action by someone.
Yes. That's exactly right.
Because, sure, an astronomer, it makes a practical effect mm-hmm. in that person's life.
Yeah.
It doesn't affect my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm still supposed to think of it as...
Well, okay, I think...
As a belief or whatever the term is.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said a personal action versus an action of some sort or something like that. And so this circle here describes personal action. And this big circle here that I label practical effects is action of some sort. And so if we were to bring Peirce into our room here and say, well, what do you think about it? What do you mean by this? He would have said, no, I didn't mean personal action. I meant action of some sort. So really you should label this big circle action of some sort. See what I mean? So I think that's probably a better answer. But anyway, I thought, I neglected to read one little thing out of here, and I think you'll find this clarifying also and interesting. And this is in between two quotes that I did read. I'll start with the first one, and I'll end with the second one, and I'll read everything in between, because it's interesting. So he says, you know, this is what I read before. Now, the identity of a habit depends on how it might lead us to act, right? That's the habit somewhere here, right? It might lead us to act. Not merely under such circumstances as are likely to arise, but under such as might possibly occur. So it's very, very broad, in other words, no matter how improbable they may be. What the habit is depends on when and how it causes us to act. As for the when, every stimulus to action is derived from some perception. As for the how, every purpose of action is to produce some sensible result. Thus, we come down to what is tangible and conceivably practical as the root of every real distinction of thought, no matter how subtle it may be, such as the Copernican theory. And there is no distinction of meaning so fine as to consist in anything but a possible difference of practice. All right, now that's part of it. I read that part yesterday. I mean, last week, you know. But now here's the middle part that I didn't read, and this is an example he gives, and actually an example he gives from theology, so it's very appropriate in Sunday school class. To see what this principle leads to, consider in the light of such a doctrine as that of transubstantiation. The Protestant churches generally hold that the elements of the sacraments are flesh and blood only in a tropical sense. They nourish our souls as meat, and the juice of it would our body. So in other words, in a sort of metaphorical sense, they're, you know, flesh and blood in that sense. But the Catholics maintain that they are literally just meat and blood, although they possess all the sensible qualities of wafer cakes and diluted wine. We can have no conception of wine except what may enter into belief, either that this, or that, or the other is wine, or that wine possesses certain properties. Okay, fine. Okay, anyway, such beliefs are nothing but self-notifications that we should upon occasion act in regard to things as we believe them, as we believe to be wine according to the qualities which we believe wine to possess. The occasion of such action would be some sensible perception and the motive of it to produce some sensible result. Thus, our action has exclusive reference to what affects the senses. Our habit has the same bearing as our action, our belief the same as our habit, our conception the same as our belief, and we can consequently mean nothing but by wine but what has certain effects, direct or indirect, upon our senses. And to talk of something as having all the sensible characters of wine, and yet being in reality blood, is senseless jargon. Right? In other words, he's saying, okay, what is the practical effect of the theological difference between the Protestants and the Catholics? The practical effect is, it looks like wine, it smells like wine, it tastes like wine, you know, and same with the wafer, of course. Now, it is not my object to pursue this theological question, and having used this as a logical example, I drop it without caring to anticipate the theologian's reply. I only desire to point out how impossible it is that we should have an idea in our minds which relates to anything but conceived sensible effects of things. Our idea of anything is our idea of its sensible effects. And if we fancy that we have any other, we're just deceiving ourselves. Hi. Rick. Patty. Rick just came in.
So the key word is sensible.
Yeah. The key word is also action, but I mean action in the context of ordinary experience, mm-hmm. sensation, right? I mean, all the actions we take regard, if you're sitting at a Catholic church versus a Protestant church, are identical, you know, because you're responding to what you see, mm-hmm. you know. All right, do you have anything? Okay, and we fancy.
Don,
go ahead.
What would he say about praying then, or for wish in the afterlife for which you will never have any proof?
Lead a good life because
you'll be
in heaven.
I don't have the other book with me. He did write some things on religion, and he would be one to say that, once again, I go right back to my standard circle, you know, that this circle here is wide enough to encompass what they'd be called probabilistic arguments, and slightly moving the needle to the side of, say, the existence of God or immortality. In other words, this, for the pragmatists, unlike for like Comte or the logical positivists, whatever, for the pragmatists, this circle does not exclude religion. That's what's of interest to us, right? For the stricter positivists, like the logical positivists in the 1930s, yeah, this circle is pretty darn small, and all sorts of stuff are outside and just meaningless stuff. But the pragmatists, what's of interest there is that school just did tend to draw the circle a lot bigger. And so, yeah, he would include, if there's some sort of evidence of, say, immortality or whatnot, that falls within the circle. Yeah. So then he goes on, it is absurd to say that thought has any meaning unrelated to its only function. It is foolish for Catholics and Protestants to fancy themselves in disagreement about the elements of the sacrament if they agree in regard to all the sensible effects here and hereafter. Right? And now, the last thing that I read last week. And this is the famous paragraph. It appears, then, that the rule for attaining the third grade of clearness of apprehension is as follows. Consider what effects that might conceivably have practical bearings we conceive the object of our conception to have. Then our conception of these effects is the whole of our conception of the object. Consider what effects. Well, that's a very broad way of putting it, right? So, in other words, if you go back to the sacrament business, what are the effects? Well, the effects are, well, this sure smells like wine and tastes like wine and so forth, and this sure looks like a wafer, et cetera, et cetera. That's the practical effects in that case, and my response to that are the actions in the world that we live in. And there ain't no difference. So there's no theological difference, even though they've been arguing about this for centuries, is what Peirce is saying. See what I mean? So, anyway.
But that it doesn't have to even be correct, then, if it leads to practical effects because people thought it was correct.
Oh, no, this is a criterion for meaning, not a criterion for truth. See? You of course, are going to use the practical effects to figure out if it's true or not, right? But, I mean, for example, to go back to your original question with the Copernican theory versus the Ptolemaic theory, the Copernican theory will predict that Venus will have phases. The Ptolemaic theory will predict that Venus won't have phases. Those are practical effects. And they lead to actions, i.e. I get out of my telescope and now I look at Venus, and do I see phases? And depending on whether I do or don't, that will confirm either one or the other theory, or help to confirm it, I should say. And sure enough, we see phases of Venus when we look through the telescope. So I think that's the what's behind this. So it's really a very broad, you know, hi, Amanda's here. What was the, I missed that one.
You just kind of announced her like,
oh.
Hello.
Well, yeah, it's like,
I think Kat can see the effects on the door opening.
Right.
That Amanda is here.
Well,
therefore.
It's like a party at a very highfalutin, you know, place where you have a butler at the door saying,
announcing.
Amanda Buxbaum has arrived.
You know?
I'm
never gonna play it again.
See, it pays to come on time.
Okay, magician will say, well, we'll give you a watch.
Yeah. That's okay. Well, anyway, but consider what effects that might conceivably have practical. That's a very, very broad way of putting it. And what effects it might have, that includes a lot, right? So anyway, all that, it only took 15 minutes or 20, all that in further answer to Tom's question of last week. Does anybody have any questions or comments or complaints or anything?
Before you announce the arrival of William James?
Yes, before, exactly. Exactly.
Don, you want to pretend to be William James?
Sure. Hero.
I just came in, but what does he say about mystery? Does he accept mystery?
Yeah, well, now, depending on what you mean by mystery, does it have any practical effects or not? And it could.
Okay.
It could. We're going to get into James's theories on religion at some point, but I mean, for example, if it leads to some sort of different life, for example, even if it's not observable in a scientific sense, that's still practical effects, right? So that's why I'm saying this circle winds up being drawn pretty broadly. The interesting thing is, some of their language, and you'll hear this morning, well, depending on how far I get, but some of their language sounds very positivistic. And typically the positivist's language is very, very narrow and exclusive, right? And so some of the language you'll find James using sounds, oh my goodness, that sounds like, you know, logical positivist would have been happy with that. But then the way he uses that, you wind up realizing that it's a little misleading. The language is a little bit misleading. It's really pretty flexible and much broader. One thing I don't like about James, I have to tell you, is it's also vague and just, you know, just kind of loosey-goosey. And, you know, one minute you're thinking, golly days, this guy's got a real tight system here, and he's not much is going to pass muster because he's standing sentinel, you know, very carefully over, you know, what's going to go within versus what's outside. And the next thing you know, it's all kind of come on in kind of thing. So it's frustrating in that way. But in James's defense, half the things we'll be going over were lectures, series of lectures. And of course, if you're giving a popular lecture before an audience, it's not quite the same venue where you would be inclined to be a lot more technical and a lot stricter and maybe clearer and whatever. So, you know, that's what you maybe would say in defense of that. And we're going to start with pragmatism. The series of lectures titled Pragmatism, it was 8 lectures altogether. And I forget what the, was it, probably says at the beginning, I just don't remember what the venue was. Let's see here if it says, popular lectures on philosophy. They were delivered at the Lowell Institute in Boston in November, in December 1906 and January 1907 at Columbia. So they were here in the U.S. Some of the lectures, I think, were like Gifford. One of them's Gifford lectures, I forget.
Of the varieties of religious experience.
Yeah, that was the Gifford. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, so you see, he was very, I think he was very sought after as a lecturer, because he's a good writer, I will say that. He's a lot more friendly than Peirce, and a lot, and Dewey's even less clear than William James. So, yeah, he's a good writer, and also, I've read, was a very gregarious kind of person. He was a people person, interestingly. So he wasn't a ivory tower introvert or anything like that, apparently. And so that probably had something to do with it too. So he was very popular on the lecture circuit. Well, anyway, so I'm going to start off, and this is in the first lecture, right near the beginning. Like I'm in like four or five paragraphs in of pragmatism. And it's probably the most famous part of the lecture series, the paragraphs I'm going to read you. And as a matter of fact, I would like to put this on the board, but I will demonstrate to you how things stand in here. You see what I mean? Well, that actually erases, so maybe I can... All right.
You'll have to.
Yeah, but the problem is, I kind of need paper towels. Maybe I can... Okay, this is okay. This one actually does erase. Okay, great. This is just David Hume anyway. I don't need this anymore. This is ancient history. Okay, good. Excellent. So, and by the way, if you read my book, this is what I quote in the very beginning of the book, how I use William James to sort of set up the schema of the various works that I talk about in the book. So this is real famous, and I like it. And I'm sure it's an oversimplification, you know, but there's nothing wrong with a 30,000-foot view, right? Just so long as you also go down to 20,000 and 10,000, you can have a general kind of thing. Aristotle does this all the time. Some sort of general, you think, oh, my goodness, that's it, that's simple. And then the next thing you know, well, if you look at it at 25,000, there's this exception and this qualification and whatnot. But, yeah, I don't have a problem with 30,000-foot views, and that's what you got here. The history of philosophy is to a great extent that of a certain clash of human temperaments. Undignified as such a treatment may seem to some of my colleagues, I shall have to take account of this clash and explain a good many of the divergencies of philosophers by it. Of whatever temperament a professional philosopher is, he tries, when philosophizing, to sink the fact of his temperament. Temperament is no conventionally recognized reason, so he urges impersonal reasons only for his conclusions. Yet, his temperament really gives him a stronger bias than any of his more strictly objective premises. So he's saying, well, you know, look, we're all born with a certain sort of temperament, he says. And, you know, we may think we're giving purely objective reasons for the conclusions that we draw as philosophers. We probably don't realize the effect of our inborn temperament and on our biases, you know, that are sort of inherent biases to begin with. Maybe even things that we think are plausible are thought plausible because we've been born with this particular temperament, right? That's what he's saying. Remember, James was a, his position at Harvard was a professor of philosophy and psychology. So the two really blend a lot in his writings. So anyway, temperament is really operative, even if this philosopher thinks that I'm being purely objective. Right? It leads the evidence for him one way or the other, making for a more sentimental or a more hard-hearted view of the universe, just as this fact or that principle would. He trusts his temperament. Wanting a universe that suits it, he believes in any representation of the universe that does suit it. He feels men of the opposite temper to be out of key with the world's character, and in his heart considers them incompetent and not in it, in the philosophic business, even though they may far exceed him in dialectical ability. Okay?
That's not very tolerant.
Well, there it is. Well, anyway, so in other words, you have this inborn bias. We're all born one way or the other, and it colors how we see the evidence. It colors what we think is important as evidence. A lot of things that we don't even think about it, right? Well, what are these temperaments? That's the next question, right? What are the temperaments? How many are there? 15? 2? 5? Whatever. The answer is going to be 2. Now, the particular difference of temperament that I have in mind in making these remarks is one that has counted in literature, art, government, and manners, as well as in philosophy. In manners, we find formalists and free and easy persons. I guess that's true. In government, authoritarians and anarchists at the opposite poles, right? In literature, purists or academicals and realists. In art, classics and romantics. In fact, I've often thought to myself, I've probably said in here, there's only two kinds of architectural styles when you think about it, the Greek and the Gothic. And if you think about it, there's some truth to that. What's characteristic of ancient Greek architecture? It's absolute simplicity, the geometrical kind of beauty that you have in something like the Parthenon. What's characteristic of Gothic? Well, the more Gothic you get, the more Rococo it becomes. Every little space is decorated with something or other, and you have all the arches and the whole deal. They're really neat, but it's very romantic. And I think that's one of the reasons the Middle Ages really took off in the 19th century. It has this kind of mystique about it. Whereas the Greek is very, you know, very pure, very clean lines, all that sort of thing. That's what he's thinking. You recognize these contrasts as familiar. Well, in philosophy, we have a very similar contrast expressed in the pair of terms rationalist and empiricist. Empiricist meaning your lover of facts and all their crude variety. Rationalist meaning you're devotee to abstract and eternal principles. So we have rationalism and empiricism. And frequently we can do indeed talk in those terms. We teach modern philosophy at the 30,000 foot level anyway, because there's lots of exceptions. But anyway, yeah, we talk about continental rationalists, people like Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz, people like that. And then we talk about British empiricists, people like Locke and Berkeley and Hume, whatever, as though there's some sort of wall there in the English Channel, and over there they do things weird, and over here we're all set, you know, we see reality the way it really is. So empiricists, yeah, I read that. No one can live an hour without, guess what, both facts and principles. So it is a difference rather of emphasis, true enough. Yet it breeds antipathies of the most pungent character between those who lay the emphasis differently. And we shall find it extraordinarily convenient to express a certain contrast in men's ways of taking the universe by talking of the empiricist and the rationalist temper. These terms make the contrast simple and massive. Okay, let's pursue this in a little more detail. Historically, we find the terms intellectualism and sensationalism used as synonyms of rationalism and empiricism, another way of putting it. Well, nature seems to combine most frequently with intellectualism an idealistic and optimistic tendency. Empiricists, on the other hand, are not uncommonly materialistic in the philosophic sense, of course, meaning what's out there is just matter in motion, not spirits or whatever. And their optimism is apt to be decidedly conditional and tremulous. You know, dog eat dog out there, and that's the way it is, and you just better accept it. Rationalism is always monistic. It starts from wholes and universals and makes much of the unity of things. Somebody like Plotinus, of course, would be an extreme example of that, right? The one, everything emanates ultimately from the one. Something like a Bhagavad Gita would be like that too. Brahman is all there is. Empiricism starts from the parts and makes the whole just a collection, an aggregate of parts, not a self-existing kind of thing, but the wholes are nothing but the part of the sum of their parts. Is not averse, therefore, to calling itself pluralistic. So empiricists tend to be pluralists, the opposite of somebody like Plotinus. Rationalism usually considers itself more religious than empiricism, but there is much to say about this claim, so I merely mention it. It is a true claim when the individual rationalist is what is called a man of feeling, and when the individual empiricist prides himself on being hard-headed. In that case, the rationalist will usually also be in favor of what is called free will, and the empiricist will be a fatalist. I use these terms the terms most popularly current. The rationalist, finally, will be of a dogmatic temper in his affirmations, while the empiricist may be more skeptical and open to discussion. I will write these traits down in two columns. That's why I needed to raise the board, because I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to put these two columns up on the board. I think you will practically recognize the two types of mental makeup that I mean. If I head the columns, now this is what the terms that are coming up are the terms that are famous here. Not rationalism versus empiricism, but rather if I head the columns by the titles tender-minded and tough-minded, respectively. Okay? So, let's put this up on the board, and I'll write out which side. Tender-minded's on the left. Tender-minded over here.
Tender-minded is the rationalist.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And tough-minded. All right. So now we have two columns, and I will just reproduce what he says right here. So first of all, and as Amanda just said, number one, rationalistic. And empiricist. And of course he has in parentheses, just to remind us, by rationalistic, going by principles, he says, and empiricist, going by facts. Okay, that's the first one. This is just a summary, really, of what I just read you. So, intellectualistic. Versus sensationalistic. And, you know, there's very little difference between this and this and this and this, really, because empiricism is the idea that experience is the source of knowledge. Idealistic versus materialistic. And, of course, he means this. I can't talk and write at the same time. He means this in the technical sense, right? He doesn't mean it like, oh, you're an idealist. You think the world should be this way, and everything's lovey-dovey, whatever. And you're a materialist. You just grub for money all the time. That's not what we mean in philosophy by idealist and materialist. They're metaphysical positions. A materialist is one. I'm sure you know this. A materialist is one who thinks that the reality consists of physical. Yeah, physical things, matter and motion, right? Lucretius, the Epicurean, who wrote On the Nature of Things, who was a supporter of the atomic theory. All there is out there are atoms, and they move. And there's a void, so they can move in that empty space. That's it, everything. You know, you think you have a soul, you think you have a mind, you think you have a self or whatever. Uh-uh. Well, I mean, if we can use those words, but we have to realize that they're all just reducible to atoms. They're soul atoms. They're nice and round and so forth, and they move really fast because they're round, just like, you know, round things. He says it's like poppy seeds. And you try to stack up a poppy seed in a pyramid, and a little puff of wind is going to blow them all down. Well, that's why the soul atoms are spherical, because they can move so quickly and that sort of thing. So in other words, it's a good example of a purely materialist metaphysics. Yes, John.
Are you sure that your second words are in the right column?
Second words, yes.
It seemed to me that the tender-minded would be more sensational, and the, what was it, the intellectual would be more
tender. I see. I think I see where you're coming, but I think he's emphasizing a little different side of those words. Uh-huh. As I said a second ago, empiricist means I look at experience, and experience is the source of knowledge.
Right.
Well, most of my experiences are sensations. Mm. So this is really just almost a restatement of this. And here, a rationalist is one who thinks that knowledge is a priori. In other words, knowledge arises independent of experience. So in other words, the intellect is the only thing that's operative and for its intellectual. Okay. That's what he's
part of the challenge. That word has evolved since.
Oh, sure.
Sensationalism.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course. I mean, like I said, you could take rationalism differently, too. I mean, these are we don't usually use these two words so much, but in philosophy, these four words, and we're not done yet, but these four words all have technical senses. That's all I mean.
Maybe because he's coming from the pragmatic perspective.
Well, possibly, but I think he's assuming an audience that's at least basically familiar with philosophical terminology. You know, so like I say, an idealist. What do we mean by that? Well, somebody like Berkeley, Bishop Berkeley, who says, "Well, there are souls, spirits, minds out there. There's no there. Believe it or not, Berkeley says this." This magic marker is not a physical object. It's just a perception, right? So, I mean, if you have a metaphysical outlook like that, then there is no matter. There are no physical things. All there are minds or spirits or however you want to construe it. But that we call that idealism. Not we don't mean by that, as I said, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if everybody loved everybody? That's kind of what we mean by idealism in the popular sense, but we don't mean it that way. We mean it in a technical, philosophic sense. That's all. Okay. Anyway, the point is, tender-minded thinkers, people born with that temperament. Remember, these are two temperaments. Maybe I should put that up here. Temperaments. People who have the tender-minded gene just kind of tend, this is not 100%, but they kind of tend to lean in the direction of idealism. That's what he's saying. Lost my page here. Okay, let's keep on going. Okay. Optimistic versus, of course, pessimistic. A Lucretian universe is absolutely meaningless. I mean, all there are atoms flying through the void. They clump together. No particular purpose. I mean, they clump together at random. They break up at random. Everything that is a substance as a result of the clumping of atoms will eventually break apart. This body will eventually break apart. My soul, which is all these spherical atoms, they're the first things to break apart at death. This world that we have, it's just nothing but a huge, huge, huge clump of atoms. It will eventually break apart. They'll fly through the void for thousands of years and clump together in a different way. And, of course, in Lucretius' universe, there are worlds upon worlds upon worlds upon worlds in an infinite void, all of them temporary. You know, there is no meaning. There's no purpose. Things just happen as they happen to happen. You know. Well, you might say that's a little pessimistic. But if, you know, God's in his heaven and all's right with the world, right, well, that's on the tender-minded side, right? Okay. Religious. Well, here we go again. And irreligious. Once again, I mean, Lucretius is an excellent example of this one, right? I could keep on citing him all day, right? For Lucretius, well, actually, for Lucretius, there are gods, but they exist in the intermundia, in the void between the worlds. They live an ideal Epicurean life. They figured out how to be immortal. I mean, every body composed of atoms loses atoms,
just because of there's this internal jostling around inside, and the atoms are knocked off the surface and that sort of thing. But the gods, I guess, are so smart, they figured out how to replenish the atoms they lose, so they stick around. But they could care less about what goes on Earth. They are totally oblivious to what goes on Earth. And all this stuff we do by praying to the gods and whatever, that's just so much of a waste of time, says Lucretius. Not only a waste of time, but it leads to horrible outcomes. So Lucretius would certainly be one of the ones who says that if you ask the question, is religion a force of good or evil, he would say definitely the latter. So clearly a good example of an anti-religious sentiment. But, of course, take Plotinus on the other side. Golly days, I can't think of a much more religious thinker than Plotinus. I mean, Plotinus, of course, was the great inspiration for all of medieval philosophy. I don't think that's an overstatement. I have said many times, this is a totally off the subject, but Plotinus is the most underrated philosopher of all time. because his view, many things, for example, that Augustine is lauded for, he got from Plotinus. you look at medieval Islamic philosophy, many, many commentators classify it as a subspecies of Neoplatonism. Plotinus is the originator of so-called Neoplatonism. There are Neoplatonic elements in Thomas Aquinas. I mean, it's all over the place in the Middle Ages and beyond, you know. Well, Plotinus is this incredibly religious thinker, right? I mean, his God is the One, and everything emanates from the One on down to the material world that we see here. But ultimately, matter doesn't even exist. Matter is just the external integument of soul. And so everything that exists is a spiritual entity for Plotinus. So, I mean, he definitely drew on the left-hand side there. Tender-minded thinker par excellence, right? Okay, we got three more going here. Free willist. Free willist. And what, fatalistic? Not surprising. Once again, Lucretius, with the exception of the atomic swerve, everything is the way it is because of the ways atoms collide and join and all that sort of thing. Everything is determined by the motions of atoms. There's no free will. But on the other hand, if you have a sharp break between, you know, the material world and a spiritual world, somebody like Immanuel Kant, who argues that the noumenal world, the world of things in themselves, are beyond the realm of causation. Therefore, totally free. Monistic. Once again, Plotinus being the paradigm of that. The One is all there is. Brahman, in the case of the Bhagavad Gita. Pluralistic. And finally, this is a little unfair, but don't take it unfairly. Dogmatical. That word has a negative connotation. I don't think he means it that way. And skeptical. But it is true that tender-minded thinkers tend to be more confident in speculating about metaphysical questions. And the positivists who drew this circle and say, okay, what's in it and what's out of it? Well, that's basically a recipe for skepticism, right? Or at least skepticism about certain things. Because this is the limits of human knowledge right here. So anything that goes outside, and in the narrow logical positivist sense, that would include ethics, aesthetics, religion, all those things, meaningless. So skeptical to a high degree.
But a tender-minded thinker is going to be more, a little bit more generous in what amounts to something that we at least can commit ourselves to. See what I mean?
I didn't quite catch pluralistic in the sense, because how is that was that a religious term, pluralistic here, or something?
No. Think about Plotinus versus Lucretius, you know, or the Bhagavad Gita versus Lucretius, maybe. It's a metaphysical question. Is everything really one?
So it's not whether there's one God.
Not at all. Is everything really just a thing? Now, of course, it's a tendency, right? Or is it just this big multiplicity out there? Infinite number of atoms. Lucretius, pluralist. He goes on, and this is true too. He says, most of us have a hankering for the good things on both sides of the line, right? I mean, you know, right, we do. He says, facts are good, of course. Give us lots of facts. Principles are good. Give us plenty of principles. The world is indubitably one if you look at it in one way, but as indubitably it is many if you look at it in another. It is both one and many. Let's adopt a sort of pluralistic monism, he said. Everything, of course, is necessarily determined, yet, of course, our wills are free. A sort of free will determinism is the true philosophy, and the evil of the parts is undeniable, but the whole can't be evil, so practical pessimism may be combined with metaphysical optimism, and so forth. Your ordinary philosophic layman, never being a radical, never straightening out his system, but living vaguely in one plausible compartment of it or another to suit the temperaments of the successive hours. That's very true. I mean, it's like being a Republican or Democrat, maybe, but I shouldn't even get into that, wade into that particular. But, yeah, I mean, we all of us have a certain feeling about the things under both sides of these. We like to think of ourselves as being critical thinkers, right? Well, when we do that, we're putting on our tough-minded hat because we're kind of saying, well, you know, it's probably good to be skeptical. You know, it doesn't hurt you. It's a good thing to be, say, prove it to me, you know. But on the other hand, isn't it nice to have an optimistic, or that right here, view of the world and think that all is not lost? In fact, sometimes I think that's kind of the essence of religion, really, you know. It's a sort of that wonderful hymn, which I hardly can even quote without crying. You know, this is my Father's world. And that last verse, it ends with, the Lord is king, let the heavens ring, God reigns, let the earth be glad, right? This is my Father's world. Why should my heart be sad? Isn't that right? That was the second last part of that. I forget how the verse starts. But anyway, that outlook that, yeah, history is out there, but I have some sort of inner, assurance that it's going in the right direction, even if there are lots of detours along the way. Wrong detours, right? So that's an optimist. So we like that too, right? So in our heart of hearts, yeah, we're confused. We're confused. And so where we're going to start, I'm out of time, but where we're going to start next week, then, he's going to present, pragmatism. Well, pragmatism, I hope, he says, is going to be able to do justice to both sides of this. Wouldn't that be nice? I'm not sure it does, but that is the ideal. So anyway, we're out of time, unfortunately. So see you all.
Facts versus principles go in that chart.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, he put that up there, but this would be principles over here and facts over here. Actually, he did, in parentheses, because wherever I was. After rationalist, he said going by principles, and after empiricist, he said going by facts. So
They were in there. I just didn't put them on the board.
Don,
yeah.
It occurs to me that when you read the word materialistic, if you just take the five parts of material, what everything is made of.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's where it came from, really.
I'm going to take a picture.
Okay.
Hi there, how are you?
Hi. Yeah, I'm
Kate.
Oh, wow.
Okay, I'll look at it.
It took me like four or five.
Yay.
Where's my Myers-Briggs?
Yeah, that's really what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. ISTJ.
Yeah. Very cool.
Oh, wow. Oh,
nice. I will be
my mother makes it. Make sure you write up.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Okay, all right. Where are you going?
20 years, she told me.
Yeah, we got,
and Laura's parents just moved in.
Right.
And Amanda's mother-in-law lived there too.
She passed away several years ago.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah,
yeah.
So where's your mom?
My mother-in-law passed away.
Okay, well, we'll miss you, but I guess we won't have class next week.
Two weekends we're going to be hopefully in Florida.
Well, that's
nice. COVID allows us to be.
Yeah, well, be careful.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
See ya.
I just now ripped my jacket.
That, you gotta
oh, no.
The whole thing.
Oh, well.
Well,
so this is,
what?
See, I just walked
well,
by
I'm going to go look in the daylight today and see if I need to touch
it. Things
up,
in life,
you know, like,
right?
Did I miss any place?
I bring a hammer.
No, know, because
thank
it was white
much.
Before and it's white now, Jay.
Right.
I don't mind doing some of that stuff.
Huh, nice to have you.
Good to be around.
Yeah. Yeah. How often do you go back to Washington?
I was traveling last weekend overseas, so.
You weren't at the.
I didn't go to Alaska.
Oh, okay.
I went to Qatar.
Huh? Really?
We have Al Udeid Air Base. Well, we don't. The Qataris have Al Udeid Air Base, and that's where a lot of the Afghan evacuees have flown in.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's so, right. I've read about that.
So we've been went there to visit the Qataris and what they're doing to help with the evacuees, and visit with our folks to look at the operation.
Okay.
As well.
That's so good.
It's mainly a State Department run operation.
I see.
I'm on the Armed Services Committee, so that's a lot of our women and men who are
right.
helping to facilitate that.
Right, right.
Well. Plus all the other crazy things going on in that region. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My
so
God.
So that's where I was last Sunday.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Oh, I was just reading that sickening story on the front page about the refugees in Belarus.
I haven't read that. I haven't read the paper this morning, but Lukashenko is a horrible, horrible
yes.
human being.
Oh,
and,
yes.
I was in Lithuania in August, and that was just starting.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going into Iraq, and the Belarusians are going into Iraq and saying, if you will fly to fly here, then you can just walk across
right.
to the west.
Right.
Right. Well, of course they can't.
Right.
And the Lithuanians, the Poles are well within their rights to.
Yeah.
Stop it from happening.
Right, but the poor people.
And Lukashenko doesn't care about
I know it. I know it.
No, he's using them as a weapon.
Exactly. It's interesting. We just, in my Ali class, we've just been studying Kant, and we just barely finished the part of Kant where Kant says one of the formulations of the supreme principle of morality is you never should use another person as a means to an end.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I read this in the paper this morning, I think. That's what he's talking about.
Yeah, yeah. The Lukashenko principle.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, sanctions and...
I know.
And the EU has basically said, we're not going to play, you know.
Yeah.
We're going to... You want... You didn't like these sanctions? Wait till you
hear the next one.
Wait till you hear the next one.
Yeah.
So,
boy, I tell you, but then
really
the poor
horrible.
People, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it is amazing. I mean, it's essentially the same problem that we have with poorly governed Central American countries. And if I don't blame them.
Like
I do the same thing, right? If I were in Honduras, I'd probably want to get to a place where there was peace and rule of law and tolerance and all that. Despite our faults, it's a lot better than a lot of other places. In Haiti, you know.
Oh, yeah, Lord. So I'll go and
read
this.
I'll get the discussing. Anyway, well, it's good to have you when you're here.
I'm just trying to catch up. Oh, in the circle here, the circle of life, we've got the return on investment? No.
Yeah.
What is
that circle? I forget. You've been here and there, but
yeah.
You know, remember, I started off with. Well, actually, Newton.
I remember this. I was here for this.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Okay.
Analog synthetic variation.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Well, the circle was simply supposed to represent. I was talking about positivism. So this circle is the limits of our knowledge.
Oh, okay.
And so what the question is really, what's outside the circle? What's in and what's outside, you know? And it really depends on, as I keep on saying, how big the circle is.
Yeah.
And you look at the logical positivists in the 1930s, that circle is just tiny.
So what is
ROIAP?
I was
showing that...
Okay, what is it?
Well, I've erased it now, but Hume, well, actually just... No, it's not there anymore. Relations of ideas, matters of fact, custom, habit, belief, that sort of stuff. That was Hume. And then I was saying, well, Kant has the same three distinctions, and so I put them underneath.
Right.
So this was done when I was teaching Hume and Kant.
Yeah.
But I keep on going back to this circle because that represents the boundaries of human knowledge.
Yeah.
So that's what that's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.